This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you like true crime, dark history, the haunted, and paranormal, then we think you'll like Ghost Town.
Ghost Town is hosted by me, Rebecca Lieb.
And me, Jason Horton.
We cover both notorious and obscure true crimes.
The haunted, paranormal, and unexplained.
And the dark history of everything from world events to pop culture.
There are new episodes of Ghost Town every Wednesday and Friday.
Find out for yourself what Vulture.com called essential listening, and one listener called a total waste of time.
So pause the podcast you're listening to right now.
And go subscribe to Ghost Town for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And at ghosttownpod.com.
Warning. This episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. 1925, Coles County, Illinois. It's a quiet morning on a farm, and Thomas Seaman is looking for his sister-in-law, Cora Stallman. While searching the property, he walks past a covered cistern and notices its planks askew. He says something along the lines of, "I hope she's not in there," and then peering into the darkness, he sees not a reflection, but a body, fully clothed, slumped in about 3 feet of cold water. Investigators surmised that this was a suicide. But there is so much more to this unsolved mystery, from assault by a strange man, threatening letters, a coded diary, and connections to the KKK, only one thing is certain. We still don't know what happened to Cora Stallman. This is a study of strange. Welcome back to the show. I am your host, Michael May. The mystery surrounding the death of Cora Stallman is a big story. It is complex, it is confusing, and it is very strange, so it's appropriate for this show. And needless to say, I almost gave up on covering this story because I was getting lost in it. And I was like, there's no way I can share this with an audience. But I invited on what might be the world's expert on the life of Cora Stallman, and that is Tori Brevett from GraveyardSnoop.com. Everybody check out her site. It is amazing. However, I'm going to introduce her after I share the basics of this story so that she can dive into more details and depth and color. We're also going to present some theories, one theory of which comes straight from Tori, and it completely shocked me and caught me off guard. So you're going to want to stick around to hear that. Lastly, I want to say this was first introduced to me as a murder mystery. However, I think it's probably more appropriate to call this a death mystery, because one of the strange things about this story is we don't know actually how she died. So let me talk to you about Cora Stallman. On the morning of Saturday, August 1st, 1925, near Humboldt Township in Mattoon, Illinois, farm owner Anna Seaman was away on a riverboat trip. Her sister, Cora Stallman, was looking out for the farm. Her job, indeed, was to manage the business affairs of the property and lived in a small cottage on the farm. Anna's husband, Thomas Seaman, was there to help. Around dawn, Thomas went to milk the cows. And afterwards, he came by Cora's cottage and called for her, but Cora was nowhere to be found. Tom searched the cottage, the main house, and parts of the farm, and still couldn't find her. Now growing worried, he enlists the help of farmhand Boston Boss Lily, and the two men search the property again. Here's a quote from the Herald and Review. At the Stallman place, they noticed that the boards covering an old cistern were awry, and that an old pump on the cistern top was bent over. Peering into the depths of the cistern, they discovered the body of a woman. Cora is fully dressed, sitting upright in 3 to 4 feet of water. Her hair and clothes are damp, but the upper part of her back and even part of her head is dry, theoretically from the way that she was resting in the water. They bring her out of the cistern, they try to resuscitate her, but she was dead. Another farmhand, Ed Landreth, helped Thomas carry Cora into the farm's main house while Boss called the authorities. Soon there were cops, detectives, neighbors, reporters, and the coroner all on the farm. Cora was tall, about 5'9", though she's often incorrectly reported in newspapers to be 6 foot tall, and she was physically strong. There were minor scratches on her forehead, but no broken bones, no bruising, no obvious injuries. The initial report is that Cora committed suicide due to many reasons we will cover throughout this episode. However, the coroner reported that her lungs contained no water, which ruled out drowning, and rigor mortis hadn't set in, which raises questions: how did she die, and why was she in the cistern at all? Unfortunately, those questions aren't easy to answer because some very strange things are soon found in and around the house. And not to use the word question repeatedly, but all of these strange things raise even more questions. The cistern was near the cottage Cora lived in, just feet away from the porch. It had a small circular opening covered by loose boards. And inside, where her body was found, were floating sheets of paper. And these pages, which were wet, were fished out, and they were mostly illegible. However, from what I've been able to read, they appeared to be angry letters. In Cora's cottage were more letters, a diary, and evidence that other papers had recently been burned. On her porch was found a painted sign that said, "We have got your sister scared green, read your letter." So what in the hell is going on? How did Cora die? And was she murdered? To understand the mystery, we need to understand the woman at the story's center. Here is a brief biography. Cora Blanche Stallman was born in December of 1879 in Cincinnati, Ohio. Her father, Granville Stallman, was an inventor with patents for hog scrapers and sausage stuffers and many more. Granville drifted between jobs and marriages, leaving his wife, Nellie, to raise 6 children in a crowded house. Cora thrived academically. She studied mathematics and Greek at the University of Cincinnati. She sang in a glee club and earned her degree in 1904. She then became a teacher. She never married, in an era when unmarried women were often looked down upon, and she eventually left teaching to nurse her ailing mother and sister. They died, and Cora was suddenly 40 and alone, and her options were limited in that day and age. Meanwhile, her older sister, Anna Stallman, had moved to Coles County, Illinois to help their uncle run his farm. He was very successful, and when he died, Anna inherited nearly 400 acres of this farm. In the early 1920s, Anna offered Cora a new life. Come move to Illinois, manage the books, help run the farm, and you can live here on a cottage. And that is how Cora came to live on the farm. I'm going to have my guest Tori explain more about the people on the farm and the farm setup itself. It is very interesting and unique, but to give you a general overview, there are multiple homes on the property. There's a main house that Anna lived in. There's the cottage that Cora lived in. And then sort of down the street and across the road is Thomas Seaman's house on his farm. Thomas and Anna married in 1919. However, soon after their marriage, they separated, but no one knew this until after Cora was found dead. And Thomas actually lived in his house while Anna, his wife, lived in hers at this adjoining property. Beginning in April of 1925, a barrage of anonymous letters came to the farm. And look, I'm going to be honest, these letters that are referred to are tough for me to wrap my head around, probably because information surrounding them is inconsistent and contradictory within these old newspapers. But I'm going to try to share what I know about them in a concise letter, and I'll ask Tori more about them afterwards. One letter was sent to Boss Lilly, the farmhand, warning him to be less attentive to Miss Stallman. 2 weeks later, a letter to Cora threatened to drive her off the property just as, quote, "We'll get your friend Boss Lily out of there." Over the next 3 months, these letters multiplied, one extended to 29 pages. Some demanded money, others were venomous. A few were signed with references to the KKK, because the Klan was indeed influential in the area at the time. And the letters weren't the only strange events. On Thursday, July 30th, 1925, Cora told her neighbors that a woman in a car stopped her on the road and asked, "Did you get that letter?" And then a person dressed in overalls and a straw hat allegedly attacked Cora, pushed her to the ground. And farmhands, I believe it was Thomas and Boss, that searched this cornfield for this man, and they found his hat and boots, but no attacker, which I find odd. Like, why would the attacker leave his hat and boots? Was it a part of a disguise? It's just very strange. Earlier in the week, Tom claimed to have heard a gunshot in the middle of the night. I'm going to pause that story because I want Tori to fill us in with some details about that one. And that is pretty much the Cliff Notes version of Cora's story right up until the last night of her life when she became ill. She was joined on this night by Oscar Seaman, who's Thomas's 23-year-old nephew, and his wife Eunice. They were with her until around midnight. And Cora had been asking for water. She was thirsty, and she also seemed fearful. Now, depending on the report you read, she might have asked Tom to stay because she was fearful and not feeling well, and he slept on the porch. Now, where Tom slept is up for debate because this changes depending on the newspaper you read, and also he changed his own story multiple times. There's word that he slept on Cora's porch, that he slept in the main house or on the porch of the main house or in the cottage, and that Cora might have also slept on the porch. It always changes, and it's very weird. After Cora was found, the investigation initially claimed that it was suicide, and it was suggested that Cora might have taken poison or collapsed after jumping into the water. However, the coroner disagreed, and he noted that there was no water in the lungs, the clothes above her waist were dry, and there were no signs that she had struggled to climb into the cistern. He wanted Cora's organs tested for poison, but Coles County was nearly bankrupt, and they couldn't afford that. Meanwhile, investigators come through dozens of letters, a diary which was written in code that no one's ever been able to figure out. And they also tried to figure out who was mailing these odd, threatening letters. And there's a lot of debate around that. There's a lot of suspicion that Cora was sending the letters to herself, that there was a young girl who had mailed some of the letters. There's just a bunch of interesting things about it. And honestly, if you want to get into the nitty-gritty, check out Tori's website, graveyardsnoop.com, for a lot of those specifics. A medical witness during the inquest claimed that Cora had indeed not drowned and she had not been physically assaulted. And despite all this investigation and 6 hours of testimony, the inquest produced more questions than answers. In fact, one of the experts claimed that Cora had died before she entered the cistern and that she might have been placed there. But there was no clear motive, no clear suspect, and jurors had to deliver an open verdict. Cause of death unknown. I tried my best to keep that succinct and clear, but there is a lot there, a lot of strangeness, and it's perfect time to introduce my special guest, Tori Bravett.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Tori, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Tori, I first came across your website researching Cora's story. And this is a very, I want to say convoluted might be a good word to describe this mystery. And I was going down strange rabbit holes and I was having trouble tying it all together. And I was about just to move on and not even cover it until I came across your work. And it really helped clarify a lot of things. So first, thank you for that. So tell me a little bit about your website
And also, I'd love to know about how you found out about Cora and started researching her too.
Sure. So my website, graveyardsnoop.com, I started in 2018. I've done genealogy for a very long time, since I was a teenager. And around 2007, I started putting together my curiosity about genealogy with my curiosity about graveyards, and went to a graveyard to investigate a stone that I was particularly interested in. And along the way, I ended up learning a story about my own family. And that sort of set me on a path of trying to figure out what I could find out about people who were in cemeteries, just based on my own research. And so around 2018, I started putting it together in a blog, rather than just going to graveyards and finding things out and emailing all my friends. I decided to actually write these things down for other people. So that's kind of how the blog came to be. As far as how I came across Cora, my husband had this position, this contract position with the Chicago Tribune, where he was doing data entry on glass negatives that had originally come from the Hearst newspapers and were then bought by the Tribune. And so every day he was working with glass negatives, and he would write down on scraps of paper the names on photos that he thought were interesting so that I could do my own bit of snooping. And Cora was one of those names that he wrote down, and he didn't write down anything except her name. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I Googled her, and I fairly quickly came across a story that was about this crazy spinster who had jumped into a well. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound right. I mean, it just doesn't track. It didn't sound like a logical thing a person would do. And the more I got into it, the more bananas it turned out to be.
And bananas is a great word to describe it. In your own words, tell us a little bit more about Cora herself.
Sure, I can do that. So Cora Stallman is a woman who was born toward the end of the 1800s in Cincinnati and grew up to be a teacher. She went to college and she majored in classics, and she studied Greek, and she was a teacher and worked in libraries for many years in Cincinnati. From what I can tell, she appears to have stopped that aspect of her career probably around the time her mother and one of her sisters got ill. I think she stopped work to take care of them. And after they had died, she moved to Mattoon, Illinois, which is sort of what we call downstate, which is a very small town, because her older sister Anna was living there. Her sister Anna was married to a man named Thomas, and they owned two farms together, because Anna herself had been a spinster for many years, helped her uncle take care of his farm, inherited it when he died, and then married Thomas. So they actually had a fair amount of property between the two of them. And Cora came to Mattoon to help her sister with her farm, which was kind of a strange shift for her to go from being sort of this very intellectual, went to college, was teaching, was doing a lot with books kind of person, to become a person who was more about farm life, really. She had a cottage on the property where she was allowed to kind of come and go. There was also a large main house where her sister lived. And there were, I think, even from the time she arrived, there was sort of an odd situation going on with her sister's house and her sister living there, but Thomas having his own house and living there, and Cora having her cottage on her sister's property.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit, just to paint the picture correctly so that listeners can understand this property. But it is a large farm. There's two homes, or there's two kind of main homes. There's the main home, and then there's the cottage that Cora lived in, the main home her sister lived in. But talk to us about Thomas, Anna, the sister's husband.
Yes. So it's a little, just bear with me. So Cora and Anna got married, or Thomas and Anna got married in the late 19 teens. He was actually a widow. His first wife's name was also Cora, and she had died. And several years later, he married Anna. And it seems like they started out the marriage with reasonable intentions, and fairly quickly it turned into the idea that they needed to each have their own separate space. And this was something that they weren't really forthcoming about until they were forced to be in court.
Do you think Cora knew about that? Because I imagine she would, because she's close with her sister. She lives on the property, and she's also close with Thomas, which we'll talk about. So do you think she knew about the separation?
I mean, I think she knew once she got there. I don't know if she knew what she was walking into. I don't know, but I know from newspaper articles about the subsequent inquest that Anna lived in her brick house on her property. Thomas lived in the house he had originally had with his first wife. Mm-hmm. Cora had the run of the cottage. She would cook and clean. Thomas would come over for dinner, and she would do like wife things for him.
You mean Anna, his actual wife that he was somewhat separated from, they would have dinner together, even though they were living in separate homes.
Dinner with his wife, who he didn't live with, and his sister-in-law, Cora, would do like secretarial things for him and cook for him and walk him home in the evening, which is a little unusual. I think.
Yes, it is. And, you know, to each their own.
Right. Everybody,
you know,
has,
but it is,
you know, their sort of family setups.
Of course. But I think it's important to say these things because of the mystery of it all and kind of figuring it out and what's going on and who's where and all of that.
I was going to add, during the inquest testimony, it is alluded to in the newspapers that Anna and Thomas were only married for about 3 weeks before they legally separated. And the reason that they legally separated is because he had not changed his house since his wife died, his first wife died, and he didn't want to. There's a very strong indication in the newspapers that he could not make room for her. Mm-hmm. So they separated, and then several years later, a new Cora, our Cora, sister in Cora, showed up. And then it became this really odd situation where she was, like I said, doing sort of wife things for him. She ordered a baby buggy for his grandson. She, you know, helped him with letters, and she cooked food for him and went over and cleaned his house. And it's just, it's not a situation I would be comfortable with.
Yes. It's a perfect moment to ask if you could provide any insight with Cora and Thomas's relationship. And like you mentioned, them walking home together, those kind of things.
So what I know, 90% of what I know about this whole situation comes from the newspapers. And much of that is, like I said, inquest testimony. We know that they were walking home together in the evenings because one of the neighbors actually said, they were walking home until the corn grew too high for me to see them, mm-hmm. which sounds very much like a really fabulous sort of neighbor peeking through the curtains scenario, until the corn grows too high and she can't watch down the road anymore.
Yep.
We know that they were doing that. Other than that, everything else is really hard to say. Mm-hmm. You know, I can say from what the newspapers tell us is that after she died and they took her back to Cincinnati for the funeral, Thomas came home and took to his bed for a couple days, which to me indicates that there was some sort of depth of feeling going on there beyond what you would normally feel for your sister-in-law.
Absolutely.
So we know that Cora kept a diary, which was very vague. It was purposely vague. Parts of it were written in code. There's definitely an indication in some of the diary entries that she's having arguments with people, that there's some sort of big tumultuous thing going on in her life that's so big and tumultuous she can't even talk about it in her diary.
So this is a perfect moment now to kind of talk about the lead up to her death, because there's a lot of interesting things happening. And some of the clues we have to that is the diary, are these vague mentions of things. She writes in code, which is just very intriguing. But she also claims that she's receiving letters, and I think some other people are receiving letters. So yeah, talk to me about the letters.
Yes. So one of the bananas aspects of this story is not just that Cora ends up dead in or near the cistern. And it's not just that she at least seemed to be a little too emotionally involved with her brother-in-law. And it's not enough that she also has a diary that she's keeping in code, which to me was always weird because she knows Greek.
Like, she's studied
the classics, right? Like, yeah. What are you trying to come up with something with little symbols and indications and a letter with a dad? Like, no one else around you speaks Greek. What are you doing? It doesn't make any sense to me. It's so odd. So that's not enough for this story. In addition, Cora has been, at the time she dies, has been receiving a series of poison pen letters from apparently a variety of people in town over a variety of issues, saying things like, you know, we saw you in the wheat field, you think you're better than us. And then other letters where people are apologizing for being mean to her. So she's getting these sort of like anonymous poison pen letters, but I believe Anna also gets some anonymous letters. And there are other instances in the town of people getting anonymous letters. They're kind of like, I feel like maybe the equivalent of like an unsigned comment on a blog post is mm-hmm. the letters. Like, it's one way for people to get their point across without actually like having to face you. So they come up repeatedly in this situation where she's been getting these letters, and once she is found outside the cistern by the authorities, but there are pages from these letters in the cistern itself. It's so strange. And I have never been able to figure out like what is going on. At least one of them references the Ku Klux Klan, which was in the area at the time. It's just very, very odd. And I wish I knew more or could explain more about it, except to say that they are sort of this thing that's going on in the background and people are trying to figure mm-hmm. out if she wrote them or she didn't write them. And they ultimately decide that she didn't write them. I don't think she wrote them, because typically when people write like a hoax letter, there's a goal. Like, they use the letters to some end, and she doesn't seem to have ever done that. But she was also kind of weird about it.
Yeah, that is one of the questions I had when I started researching this, is could she have written the letters? Was this, you know, for whatever emotional reason she felt the need to try to communicate or provoke reactions or whatever it may be? But the more I dove into it, I just got confused. Like, it is just bizarre.
It is bizarre.
And I'm glad that you think she didn't write it, because that's kind of the direction I ended up kind of going in the more I went into it. But I definitely had that thought at first.
She doesn't seem to have used them to her advantage, mm-hmm. other than mm-hmm. to say, like, I'm getting these letters. But there's never a point of like, oh, I need help from this. Oh, someone has to protect me. I mean, is it possible that she wrote them to try to get Thomas's attention? I mean, I've thought about it, but it doesn't seem like she ever tried to do that.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense. And also, she had his attention. They would walk home at night. They would spend time together. So, yeah, it just doesn't. It doesn't fit. And also, I'm going to jump around a little bit here, but I think it's partly because the timeline is a little confusing, and even newspaper articles, I think, say it either incorrectly or they contradict each other. So there is a threatening situation that happened with her a few days before she passed away, where she was allegedly sort of pushed down. Can you tell me that story?
Sure. Yeah. So I believe it's about a day before she dies. There's a situation where a bunch of men and field hands are in the field area at Anna's farm. Anna is out of town. So she's out of town for the whole week leading up to Cora dying. She actually comes back to town the day that Cora's body is found. Mm-hmm. So she's out of town, but Thomas and other field hands are working. They're doing various farm things on the farm. And at some point, Cora blows a whistle, I believe. And everyone comes running. And she's like, oh, some strange man in overalls pushed me down and ran away, which does sound really weird. It sounds fake.
Yes, it does.
I'm sorry, Cora. It sounds a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole very confusing situation about, did they find the overalls? Did they not? Did they get burned in a fireplace? Did they not? Ultimately, it kind of doesn't matter. You know, they find her in the driveway. She's got like some dirt on her face. And it's not the only weird situation that she had reported that day. So later mm-hmm. that day, she goes to a sort of a smaller section of buildings several miles away called, I believe it was Humboldt. And she goes to a store there, but she reports on the way there that someone stopped her and kind of threatened her. And so these things are all happening in like a very short time span, but all just about in the day before she dies.
Can we go back a few days?
Yeah.
Because there's also that gunshot incident, which is so bizarre to me as well. And then we'll come back to sure. the night she got sick. So yeah, talk to me about this gunshot.
A few days before she gets sick, earlier in this week when Anna is still gone, there's some sort of situation, and Thomas is the only one to sort of testify about this. There's some sort of situation involving her and a gun in her cottage. And it doesn't really come up until after she's dead and they're investigating the cottage and the authorities are like, whoa, what's with the bullet hole in the wall? And Thomas gives this sort of story about she was scared and she borrowed Anna's gun. And he heard a gunshot and he came running and she claimed she'd, scared somebody off, or she'd fired it because she was trying to scare somebody off. He's a little bit unclear about it. What was curious to me, and I don't know a lot about ballistics. I know almost nothing. What was curious to me was in several spots, the newspapers report that the bullet that's lodged in the wall of her cottage is sort of upwards, which is strange because it means that it was sort of fired upwards. It's weird to me that the bullet would be, it just doesn't make any sense. It's definitely yes. not someone deliberately shooting like this, and it's definitely not someone shooting at the floor. It's weird.
It's very weird. And Thomas, it sounds like there was also some confusion around where he was when the gunshot supposedly happened, yeah. because I think I read that he ran from the main house, from Anna's house, to the cottage.
Well, he wasn't okay. supposed to be, because Anna was out of town.
Right. Correct.
Yeah. He claimed he ran from the main house when he heard the gunshot. But what's problematic is that it was Anna's gun. She knew where it was and where it was supposed to be kept. And when they investigate the house, the gun is back in place. And it's mm-hmm. been fired. So it had been fired.
Yeah.
Someone put it back.
Yeah. And fired inside too.
Yes. In the cottage with a bullet yeah. upwards.
Pointed upward instead of sort of straight ahead like you would right. to shoot at somebody.
Or down.
Yeah. And so it's not like, as I think when I first read about that, I think I interpreted it as somebody shot at the house from outside, and then it quickly was like, oh no, this is inside the house.
It's inside.
And it sounds like it's likely Anna's gun. So this is super weird.
Yeah.
Just one more thing that's very strange about it.
There's and not then we, weird in this story.
No, not at all. And not to walk over sort of the schedule of events, but I like doing this and just getting all the details out. But the night or two, correct me on which one it is, that she starts to feel sick before she died. Was it two nights before or the night before?
So Thomas says she started to get sick on Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was very sick. She started to get like a little bit woozy, kind of delirious on Friday. She was very sick Friday night. He is over at the cottage with her. She is in bed, sick and hallucinating. His nephew and his nephew's wife are there. And then Thomas claims she got better and that she was able to fix a little food for him and that she went to sleep and everything seemed fine. And then the next morning, when he's going to milk the cows, he can't find her. Mm-hmm. And his story is that he looks everywhere. He can't find her. He goes and gets his field hand who lives in an adjacent house. And that man's name is Boston Lily or Boss Lily.
Boss, yeah.
He goes and gets Boss Lily and they look and they find her in the cistern. They pull her out. They give her mouth to mouth. And she's already dead.
One of the interesting things is Thomas, who, you know, apparently lived, he stayed in his old house at the farm next door.
It's like across the road.
Across the road. But on this morning, we can't seem to get really definitive about where he was sleeping the night that she passed away. Because it sounds like he was either on the porch at Anna's house or inside, or on the porch or inside at the cottage with Cora. And
I think some of that is down to conflicting newspaper accounts.
Yes.
And just sort of the chaos of the scene. But yeah, there is a definite confusion as to whether he is spending the night in the main brick house that Anna owned. Or he's spending the night on the porch of the cottage because Cora was scared and sick. Like it's never really cleared up as to exactly what was going on. And like I said, he was under instructions to not be there because Anna was out of town, which made it, I'm sure, more problematic for him on multiple levels.
Yes, it does seem very suspicious, and I think that sort of comes to fruition in a little bit. But I want to talk to you just to also clarify about how the body was found.
Sure.
You just mentioned that Boss and Thomas pulled her out of the cistern, but there's no one else around, right? It's just the two of them. And so when everybody else shows up, was she already inside? I think they had put her on a couch inside or on the floor inside or something like that.
I believe she was on the grass when the first authorities, like the undertaker and the undertaker, showed up. And then they move her, into the big brick house and put her on like the dining table or whatever.
There's an interesting description I read where she's wet except for her back or the back of her head or something like that. So yeah, if you could clarify that for us.
It's a little bit confusing. There are various reports that she's sort of wet, kind of like up to her waist. And she may or may not be wet on the front. And some of her hair is wet. She was a little bit on the taller side. She was like 5'9". So he very kindly, I very much appreciated this, I basically had him kind of stand in the hallway and try out different positions to figure out like where his body would fall depending on where they said the water in the cistern was at. Because a cistern, not to get too technical, a cistern is kind of like a well, but it's not a well. Because it doesn't pull water from the ground, it actually pulls water from the sky and it goes through like a filtering wall. So it's like a well with a wall in it. Essentially, in a pipe that comes out of the filter inside. That's how it works. So she's found in the cistern. And the question was, like, so she's in this. Thomas's story is that he was found her in the cistern and then they pulled her out and got her onto the ground and they couldn't get hardly any water out of her. First, they couldn't get any water out of her. And then the story is they got like a bunch of water out of her. And that's why there was no water in her lungs. And later the coroner was like, no, that doesn't sound right. So his story is that they pulled her out and then got her onto the ground. I believe the coroner said that she just wasn't very wet, which was sort of implied that someone like spilled water on her or threw water on her to make her clothes wet. So I think, is that kind of what you're getting at there?
Yeah, or at least there's a question, right? That was she actually found in the cistern?
Right.
And that's where I think the question comes about, which is she's not all wet. And there's also questions about how she was positioned in the cistern, which I think is it your website that you have a little diagram or a newspaper? Yes. Anybody interested in this story, please go to Graveyard Snoop and check it out, because it is very helpful to see how she could have been positioned in the cistern. But also, she had no major bruising, injuries.
Well, like maybe one scrape on her face. But
right.
That's about it. And that was sort of what led to, like, my thinking is they pull her out. She's not soaked. She wasn't like a pile at the bottom of the cistern.
Mm-hmm.
Even Thomas said, oh, she was sort of standing or leaning against the cistern pipe or leaning against the wall. At no point does anyone say like she was completely submerged. And the coroner can't really find much water at all in her lungs. And he was convinced that she had not drowned. And the implication then is that she was dead when she went in.
Mm.
She didn't like stumble into the cistern, which only had an opening of about like a foot by a foot wide. She didn't accidentally walk into it and fall and drown or hit her head and pass out and end up in the water. And it wasn't anything like that. His conclusion was that she was dead before she got in there. And my kind of feeling is, I don't know that she was ever actually in there to begin with.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so there's various theories that we'll get to, but obviously one of the first things that comes out is, oh, she committed suicide, where it's like, well, then how? Because if she didn't die by drowning, it's not like she put herself in the cistern and was like, that's the way I'm going to go out. There's not really any evidence of anything else she could have done to herself. So it's, you know, this spiral of strangeness that this story has. But yeah, let's talk about these various theories, or at least ideas that people have had. The first one I think we've already kind of debunked, which is the suicide one. It looked like you got really excited to say something. Go for it.
I thought of something that I wanted to add regarding.
Yeah, please.
The sort of triangle relationship between Anna and Cora and Thomas. In the inquest, it comes out that there had been arguments between Anna and Thomas about Cora. They don't really detail in the newspapers what they were, but Anna is forced to admit that they had arguments about her. Cora told Boston Lily's wife that Anna had hit her. So whatever was going on, I don't think it was good.
No. And I'm glad you remember to bring that up, because there's this just multi-layer of just provocative situations happening.
Yeah. And like, you know, they find her dead and then they find this weird sign on the porch of her cottage that says, "We got your sister scared green." And it's like, well, okay.
Yeah.
Like, at some point, you almost feel like, I can't even handle this anymore. This is just too much oddity and too much strangeness in one situation. Like, what could possibly be going on? How could there be all these different weird factors at the same time?
And yet layering up. And so the general ideas are suicide, murder, but that also is just kind of like a broad statement. I know people think about Thomas as a potential suspect. Anna, her sister, was out of town, but maybe they're in cahoots. Maybe they planned it together and she left or whatever. But none of those things line up. None of those things line up perfectly. And again, there's no injury. Like, she wasn't stabbed. She wasn't shot. She wasn't like held under the water. So, yeah. So it's all just, I don't think the murder thing lines up either. And that kind of circles me around to wanting to know what your thoughts are. I know we'll never 100% know, but what do you think happened? Actually, you know what? I want to ask you something else first.
Sure.
You studied genealogy. You've researched this story. I'm curious just to hear about somebody of her age in that time period, the quote-unquote spinster. And what people, what society or culture, especially in a small town, may have thought about someone like her.
So I can't speak to how she herself was treated.
Of course.
Yeah. I can certainly say that I have some theories about why she might have been a spinster. I think her parents' marriage was probably not great, and I think her father was probably hard to deal with. And as a result, neither she nor either of her sisters, well, I guess Anna got married to Thomas, but not until much later in life. Her other sister, who died in her 20s, also didn't get married. So I think she probably had reasons for maybe steering away from marriage. I think it was not the easiest path. She certainly seems to have been happy at college. You know, I found her yearbook entries where people talk about what fun she is and how she likes to write jingles and hang out with her friends. And she sounds really cool, right? And she's really loving the college life. And she seemed to really like being a teacher, and she got a lot out of that. So I'm not exactly answering your question. I think being a spinster was probably a hard road. And my guess is that once her mother and her sister and her, she also had a younger brother who had died, there was really no one left in Cincinnati who was sort of blood family for being around. And at that point, just for economic reasons, it becomes a real hard calculation for a spinster at this time period, because it's basically you're either going to have to go back to teaching and try to work to support yourself, or there's this other option where at least your house will be taken care of. You'll be near your relatives. You'll live with your sister. You'll know that you're not still alone in the world.
I think that's an interesting element to the story. It's an important element to the story, because I think who she is, the way the society works, who her family are, that all has to be part of this, because we don't have much else to go on, you know? So just looking at these situations, I think, is important. Not that they've helped me figure anything out, but they might one day.
She really wants to kind of make this calculation where she's like this very sort of urban educated person who went to college, has a degree, and she gives up life in the big city to move to a very small town where she really doesn't know anyone beyond it.
And help run a farm, which is not what her education or her experience.
In her wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems like she did okay. One of the sort of things that I noticed, I think, because I have sisters, is that once Cora dies, the first times her sister Anna talks to the paper, she's very clear in saying, my sister never would have committed suicide. She was very sane. There was nothing wrong. I don't know what happened, et cetera, et cetera. They go to Cincinnati. They have the funeral. They come back. And she has completely changed her tune, where she's like, well, my sister was crazy. She probably committed suicide. And I don't know if you have siblings, but I could not possibly do that to my sisters. Like, I can't imagine what I would have had to have learned in the interim to get me to flip 180 like that. So she comes back and she is not on her dead sister's side anymore, which is really interesting to me. And as a result, you start to see other people in town who had experiences with Cora come to the newspapers to talk about how nice she was, about how much their kids liked her. She would go around with like a pony cart or a horse cart, and the kids would jump in and she would give them rides. She would bring them gifts. Like, I don't know that she ever really lost that sort of like kid relationship that teachers have. Mm-hmm, she seems to have still sought that out in some ways.
So I want to ask you about your personal theory or theories or just ideas about what you think happened, because you came across something that I did not find anywhere else.
So I was trying to make a searchable database of facts related to Cora for my own purposes, because I would think about one aspect of it and I would try to remember like which newspaper was that in, what day was that in. And so what I did, which sounds a little crazy, a little psychotic, is I was going through newspaper stories fact by fact and just entering them into a spreadsheet. And, you know, this line came from this newspaper on this date. This fact came from this newspaper on this date. and building this database for myself. And while I was doing that, when I was doing that, one of the articles that I was going through was from the Decatur Review, which is a local newspaper nearby. And it had this one line that I didn't remember seeing, where it mentioned that an empty bottle of ergot pills was found in Cora's cottage. And I called out to my husband and I said, "Ergot, what is that?" And he goes, "Isn't that for abortions?" And I was like, "Oh, well, this is interesting." And it's frustrating to me that it only shows up in one newspaper.
One newspaper, yeah.
One line, one time. From a research standpoint, that's very frustrating. Like, I would really prefer to have more backup on that. I really would. But I can't ignore it, because the more I looked into ergot and what happens when you get ergotism, a lot of things about Cora's last week started to fall into place. So there are two kinds of ergot poisoning that you can get. Gangrenous ergotism, which is just as bad as it sounds. Or you can get, I read such fun stuff, or you can get what's called convulsive ergotism. And now ergot, as many people know, is a fungus that grows on rye. You know, it's been implicated in sort of like St. Vitus dance and witches, and it's got a history. But the way ergot works is it affects blood flow. So it is, it's like a hemorrhagic type drug. And so it has a use in obstetrics, where it can either help with blood flow or help stop blood flow. But the problem is that ergot is a very tricky thing to dose. Even today, it's used, but it's a problematic kind of drug. And you can take ergot for a long time and not have any bad effects, and it can build up in your system, and then all of a sudden, ta-da, ergotism. And some of the effects of convulsive ergotism are hallucinations, mania, nausea, seeing things, imagining things, passing out, you know, all these sorts of weird sicknesses that Cora had in her last week start to line up with convulsive ergotism. And it can actually affect the rhythm of your heart. And that is my personal theory. Ergot was one of a series of sort of emmenagogues or abortifacients that were popular at the turn of the 1900s, right around the time when Cora herself would have become an adult. She also, one of her best college friends, later grew up to be a pharmacist. Now, I don't know if this woman helped her, but I think it's enough to say that these things were probably in the air when she was coming of age.
Mm-hmm.
They were less popular, from what I can tell, in the 1920s when Cora died, but it still would have been around and accessible. I don't think she was trying to cause an abortion. I think she maybe thought she needed one. And I think it's also good to understand that the sort of like how we think of pregnancy is different than it used to be.
Yes, yes.
Because at that time, long decades before you had the idea of a home pregnancy test or even an easy test at the doctor, you kind of waited until you felt a quickening, and then you knew for sure you were pregnant. So that's part of her world. Another part of her world is the idea that there was sort of this medical concept that like a suppressed menstruation or a menstruation that wasn't happening was unhealthy for you. And so you see ads from that time and times before were for things that will help fix that. Mm-hmm. And I think probably on some level, I don't know if she thought she was pregnant. I have no way of knowing. For whatever reason, she thought she needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottle was empty. So she had probably been taking it for a while.
One of the things I that clicked with me when I read your site about this theory is, you know, I always try to find that simple answer for things. Where is you know, a mystery or a strange story, where is it the simplest? And usually that's when everything starts to make sense. It's figuring out the puzzle. And this theory, even though it's all presumptive, or, you know, we don't know these things for sure.
Totally agree.
But it does start to paint a clearer picture of all these unexplainable things. They start to fall in line. I think a lot of people are going to presume that, oh, maybe Thomas and her were having a sexual / emotional relationship, which that could have caused the argumentative relationship with her sister. But again, that's just going down this line of,
right,
of assuming things and going from there. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to know from the little that we have in the newspapers. And I'm the kind of person who I really prefer more facts. I don't like a lot of speculation.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me sort of like a long time to like be okay with this conclusion. But ultimately, whatever was happening, the things that I can point to and that we can point to are that she had a diary she was keeping in code. Other people thought something was going on. There was clearly some sort of conflict between her and Anna and Thomas. All of her symptoms line up with convulsive ergotism. There's a whole weird sort of like side story where people are claiming that in her hallucinations, she was saying, "That man made me take something. A man made me take something." I mean, I don't think Thomas made her take anything. I think she probably took something voluntarily. And I think she probably took a drug that she was familiar with. And ergot is just tricky.
Yeah.
And she just ran into that situation where it messes with your heartbeat and she died.
That's the big final question here is, you know, we have this theory about the ergot, but yeah, how did she die? And then how did everything else sort of happen? The wet body, the cistern story, which may not have even happened.
Like I talk about in the blog, what's hard, what is ultimately essential is there's this 6 hour or so gap between when Thomas's relatives leave her cottage and the next morning when he's going to Boss Lily to try and find her body or trying to find her body. And the only person who knows what happened in that period is Thomas. And I can certainly see a couple different scenarios where she dies and he's not there and he comes in and he's like, "Oh no, this is not good. I have to do something." I mean, that's not a great theory, I don't think, because then it implies that he was like, "Well, okay, let's get some of those letters and scatter them around and you know, spill some water on her front to make it look like she drowned in the cistern." And like it just puts an awful lot of thinking into a situation that was probably pretty nuts. I think more likely what happened is he was probably sitting next to her bed and she died. And he probably saw her die, is my guess.
To me, there is something about all of this craziness that looks and feels like somebody panicking.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. You know, it's hard because, like I've talked about, trying to parse what is true in the newspapers versus sort of what is hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
One of the newspaper accounts talks about Thomas going to Boston Lily's house to get help to find Cora. But he shows up and he's kind of like, "Well, let's look all these other places. And boy, I sure hope we don't find her in that cistern." It's like, okay, this is a little bit ridiculous, but boss works for him, right? Like if your boss came to you and needed help with something and like, he literally owns the land you're living on. So yeah, there's definitely a feeling of like them sort of throwing it together.
Yeah.
At the last minute, or maybe Thomas throwing it together at the last minute. There's just no way to know, you know. I have turned this case like six ways to Sunday, upside down and shaking it as best I can, you know, with the limited sort of resources that I have. There aren't, my understanding is there really isn't much left as far as documentation in Coles County, where all of this took place. Very sweetly, the coroner was actually nice enough to call me on the phone after I pestered him over the email. And, you know, he was like, well, I don't know. The courthouse is flooded a couple times. I don't know if you're going to find anything. And all he could really find was just sort of like the judgment document from the inquest that basically gives the no judgment, really. Mm. And that's really all that's left. So I am happy to listen to other theories. You know, ultimately, what's most interesting to me is the three people sort of at the center of it. And like I talk about in the blog, they're all wanting the same three things. They all want love and peace and calmness. And each of them gets like two of those things. You know, and it just really sits with me, sort of these three people trying to work it out, and they just can't. They just can't. Nobody in this situation ends up happy.
And I think that human element is what makes this compelling to me, because it sticks with me, as I'm sure it does with you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I really feel for them. I feel for Thomas, you know, trying to make this new marriage work when clearly he's still not over his late wife, his first wife. And now he's got this situation with his sister-in-law. I feel for Cora, who, I don't know, maybe she didn't have any idea until she walked in and was like, oh, this is a very different scenario than I imagined. How is this going to go? And I feel for Anna, who spent like her whole youth kind of helping her uncle with his farm and put all of sort of her needs aside and finally got married. And 3 weeks later, it was like effectively over. So I really feel for all of them. I really do. Cora's, she's a very compelling person. You know, I have a lot of sort of personal feelings for her and wishes for her as to how I wish things had turned out. So I'm always happy to talk about her, and I'm glad you reached out to me.
Yeah. And everybody, please check out graveyardsnoop.com. You do such wonderful stuff. I will definitely use you for resources in the future. You've already suggested a story to me that I'm going to research. But yeah, if you like history like I do, and just interesting real stories and searching about the history with people, it's just a fantastic sign. You do a great job.
Thank you so much.
And honestly, if anybody's really interested in this story and wants to know more, I suggest I'll put a link to the site directly to Cora Stallman's articles. Do you call them articles or blogs? What do you call them?
I call them posts.
Posts, okay.
The story took much longer to write than I thought it would. It's about 15 posts. So it's good for a long weekend if you don't have anything else to do. And there are also some excerpts from the diaries and photographs.
Yeah. Basically, I think any sort of pertinent information is in there. There's obviously a lot more in other newspapers and things, but you do show a lot of those. You show the diaries, and you went into a lot more detail than we're able to do on a podcast. So I do recommend it highly. But thank you so much, Tori.
Thank you, Mike.
You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.
The rivalry that shaped football. The players who defined an era. For the first time ever in LA, the icons of FC Barcelona and Real Madrid take the pitch at BMO Stadium. Watch the Legend Series, FC Barcelona Legends versus Real Madrid Leyendas, live in LA on February 22nd at BMO Stadium. For tickets and exclusives, go to wearehouseofheroes.com.